You don't belong here. You aren't from here. Everything you and your family has is because of white people. You should be happy that we've let you live here for as long as you had. This is our country, our place, our home. If you don't like it, go back to where you came from, because you really don't belong here. You really can't complain about it. You can't talk about it. Love it or leave it, because you're not really from here. Of course, my heart sank as I heard these words coming across the phone. I was stunned. My little sister called me that night, shook and upset because someone had said that to her. It was the night that Donald Trump was elected president, and more than half of the country made a decision that would deeply affect the most vulnerable and marginalized people for generations. And so, as if that wasn't enough to deal with, she was trying, like the rest of us, to find her voice, to have a sense of political awareness. So she took to Facebook to express her sadness, her despair, her discontentment, hoping that the virtual community that she had built over the years would come to her aid. She put her feelings of helplessness out there about how she felt ignored and failed by her country, retaliated against as a black woman. She thought there would be wide resonance in her vulnerability, but to her surprise, there was deep hostility from friends that she thought she had groomed over the years, who grew up in church with her and played sports with her and hung out at each other's houses, who even coined a nickname for her. You don't really belong here. You're not really from here. Everything you and your family have is because of white people. You don't really belong here. 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 How often do we hear messages telling us that we don't really belong here? How often do we put ourselves out there hoping to be vulnerable and emotional, that people might come to understand through the story that we have, through our struggle, that we're seeking to belong to a place? How many kids in our midst, adults in this room, how many people hear those words, "You don't belong here," and are immediately triggered by the years, perhaps decades, of exclusion? You don't really belong here. As I read through our scripture passage this morning, I can't help but hear this undertone in this text. I know we don't spend a ton of time with the epistles here, so this Galatians passage may not be as familiar to some of you, even though it's one of the seven authentic letters that we believe that Paul wrote as he established the Christian community there. Paul, in this community, is in crisis. People who were just told and accepted that they belong in the church, that the church is for them, includes them, was built for them, have now been told by some missionaries that they don't really belong there. That as Gentiles, they're not really descendants of Abraham. They aren't legitimate members of the church. And if they want to become legitimate members of the church, they want to become true children of Abraham, then they must shed their Greek, pagan, Gentile, heathen, savage, unclean identity. And so they're left a bit confused. Paul had just preached this gospel of inclusion. He was doing better here than he has done in some other places. And yet people were immediately finding themselves excluded from community because of what they ate or didn't eat, what they wore or didn't wear, what they looked like and sounded like, the spices that they put in their food. They were told that they did not belong because their cultural identity was not good enough. Surely this isn't your first time hearing this, right? How often do we tell people they don't belong here because they don't have the right culture? How often do we conflate cultural norms with moral teachings? How often do we practice cultural imperialism in the church, in the country, in the workplace, in our schools, in our curriculum, in our theology? How long do we tell people, how much do we tell people that they don't belong because they don't have the right culture? How often do we tell black kids, black people, that there is something degenerate in their culture? And that's why they have certain problems. That's why they have certain issues. How much do we tell people that because of what they dress and what they listen to and how they walk and talk and sound, that they're less than human? How often do we as a nation, as a people, as a church, say to Latinx people that there's something inherently wrong in their culture? That their languages, the languages that they speak, the places that they are from, the traditions that they have, the food, well, we sort of like the food. We just don't want to connect it to their stories, that there's something bad about their culture. How often do we say the Caribbean nations are weak because of bad culture? Amaka, African nations fail because of bad culture. Latin American nations are corrupt because of their culture. How often do we make judgments on other people's cultures and equate that to a moral assessment? How cemented, Chris, is that in the logic and practices of the church and the state? How often are we practicing cultural imperialism that's actually an impediment to people knowing that they belong in the fold of God? How often do we conflate moral imagination with cultural hegemony? How long has the worship of the church, the liturgy of the church, the theology of the church, the business of the church, the pedagogy of the church, the socialization at church, how long has the essence of church been understood through a Eurocentric framework? How long has our conception of morality, of right and wrong, of good and bad, been construed through the cultural norms of Europe and not the moral imagination of our God and people all over the world? How long have we been practicing this cultural imperialism that's central to this story? See, to really understand what Paul is doing in this text, we have to take a few steps back and ask questions about the church and the Christianity that we have. Dr. Willie Jennings of Yale Divinity School puts this way. He says, the Christian imagination is a diseased social imagination that comes to us through supersessionist thinking. You know, the Sunday school kids got on me for using these big words that I don't explain. So supersessionist thinking, right, is this idea that now Christians have taken over the divine election given to the Jewish community. Now Christians have been elected with the divine promises. So they've been given divine authority. And so he goes on and says that Christians reconfigure God's attention to Israel to be attention for them. That now they use and elected the white body with divine authority to carry out God's will in the world. Dr. Jennings continues, this authority gave whites in the age of discovery the authority to control landscapes and people all over the new world. For those of y'all who work for the federal government, you're off tomorrow because of Columbus Day. Don't think I wasn't going to talk about it. The church, the Pope authored two papal bulls, one in 1452 and the other in 1493, that gave the authority of European explorers to, quote, capture, vanquish, and subdue the pagans the Saracens, and other enemies of Christ to put them into perpetual slavery, to take all of their possessions and property. That doctrine was later expanded by the founders of America and merged with the Manifest Destiny. That what was first extended to Israel was now extended to white Europeans, was now extended to white Americans. And so now today, the culture of Europe and the culture of whites have been conflated with moral authority to shape the whole world, regardless of how the rest of us practice and consider and think about our moral selves. The culture of the rest of the world in this ideology is savage. It's primitive. It's pagan. It's Gentile. It's tribal. It's pathological. And so until these people change their culture, we were told, they'll never be included, or really they'll never be good. Really, their nations will never be self-sustainable. And so we see this logic in the text. The Gentiles are told that their culture is bad, that their culture is unchristian, that their culture is immoral. And so they write this letter to Paul demanding answers. Paul, do you agree that there's something wrong with our culture? Paul, do you agree that there's something that we should be ashamed of, something that we should hide, something that we should not celebrate anymore? Do you agree that we should not belong unless we become like that other culture? They want to know. And oh, friends, these Gentile Christians help us more than we know. They're asking questions that we, in fact, need the answer to. They were not simply satisfied with just sitting in the same room as people that were different from them and conforming their lives and lifestyles and moral imaginations simply because they were imposed on them. They sat there aware of the potential for discursive power, the power to control the discourse and the narrative, that they didn't raise questions about how their lives fit into this, how their stories, how their practices, how their family units fit into this. They help us because they push Paul and they push the church to make it clear, will this be a religion of cultural imperialism or will it not be? Will it be a religion where moral imagination can be found in many different places? I hope y'all are still with me. This is the questions at the heart of this text. And friends, this is the question today. What is the origin of morality? How can I build a moral system and framework? How do I know what the good is? And what does that have to do with my culture, my identity? How can I fit in to the system, this church, this community, this nation, this family, this relationship, this schema? How can I be good? How can I be made in the image of God and have a place in this world? Am I supposed to leave my culture behind? Perhaps it seems heretical to you because you may not have heard it put this way. But our moral systems should have a plurality of origins. Our moral systems should be influenced by a plurality of cultures and identities. Our moral system should be made up with ideas from people all over the world, and we must sit with them and learn from them how over time and in different spaces they've constructed a moral imagination bigger than most of the ones handed to us. Are y'all still with me? If we keep pushing I think in our youth Sunday school, they're struggling with this text this morning. I think if we push further, they've gotten some of the prepositions wrong. I think what Paul is actually trying to communicate to them, not that there isn't Jew nor Greek, or male or female in other genders. I think what Paul is trying to say is in Christ, there must be Jews and Greeks. There must be males and females. I think he is trying to abolish slavery, but he's trying to say that now slaveholders and their descendants have some work to do in regards to the enslaved and their descendants. That in Christ, if you're gonna become one community, become one people, then we gotta bring in a bunch of different cultures, a bunch of different identities, and a bunch of different worldviews that the cultures bring in. Perhaps this text then is better understood as an invitation for people to grapple with plurality, to grapple with living in a diverse culture and society, to grapple with how not to replicate cultural imperialism. Perhaps this text is a challenge to the social system and the social order that says that one way of thinking is the only way to be. Perhaps this text is trying to help them redistribute the power in the church so that other cultures can have their influence too. But see, this is tricky because for some of you, this process of becoming plural, we must name that in an effort to balance the scales, to share the power and influence, to redistribute the resources, we're going to overemphasize and overcorrect in some spaces that have been marginal and vulnerable. We're going to build up our understanding of belonging from the farthest ends of the sideline. And that's going to trip a lot of people up because it's going to seem like we're giving preferential treatment, as Gustavo Gutierrez says, to the poor, and James Cone says to black people, and Dolores Williams says to black women, and queer liberation theologians say to queer black undocumented people. And all of that is true. We're going to start with them and say to them, help us figure out how to build a plural society. A society where everyone can belong. We're going to say to them, tell us your story of how you've been excluded and what can we do to now include you in the new framework. We're going to say to them, bring in your culture and help us imagine a moral order that takes your culture seriously. Bring in your culture and help us imagine a moral system that takes your culture seriously. Bring in your culture and help us imagine a moral system that takes your culture seriously. See, for many people, that is not the work of Christian community, but this definitely is the work of Christian community. See, if we're going to say you belong here, all of you must belong here, if we're going to do life together, to love together, to be in community, and to transform each other in this world together, then we must do it together. Your full self must be welcomed in this place. And that includes your ancestry. That includes the cultures that we still have links to and the cultures that we don't. I think to put it differently, what I'm trying to say is that a starting point for moral imagination is to embrace our indigenous identities and cultures. What do you think about that? Is that compelling to you? The culture, music, food, family, folklore, friendship, literature, philosophy, folk wisdom. that that's a launching pad for collective moral system. Do you get what's at stake with that? See, for me, part of what is at stake is after you watch the twins get dedicated and you see our kids playing around, we see what is at stake. When me and Amaka had that conversation in August, she started talking about how she wants her children to know that despite the constant messages she was hearing, that they know for themselves that they belong somewhere. That they belong here in this church, that they belong here in this nation, that they belong here in this world. And the things that make them who they are good things. See, when we keep pushing it, we realize that the kids who come to this church are an embodiment of the vision that we want for them. See, there are people who live in multiple worlds, black, white, Latino, Asian, documented, undocumented, poor and educated, working class, affluent, but they have a plurality of stories. They live plural lives. And one way of doing things isn't going to make sense for the world that they live in, and it won't make sense for our world either. As they ask questions of where do I belong, how do I belong, they try to make sense of the Spanish they speak at home, the German they learn on the weekend, and the Mandarin they use to communicate with their grandparents, and the Igbo and Tree they speak to their cousins, and the Vietnamese that they're trying to study, and the American vernaculars that they're saying in school. They try to make sense of all that. They're going to need a plurality of sources to help them. A plurality of Christian upbringings to advise them. They're going to have to hold their Christianity with the Day of the Dead, with the Santeria of the elders, and the African spirituality of back home. They're going to have to make sense of the life in all its complexities so that they can find the sources that are most useful for them. See, when we ask this question of belonging, it's not some shallow or nice thing, but it's one of eschatological urgency. It's big. It's happening right now. It's intense. Is there a place for me? Is there a space for me? Is there a space for her? Is there a church for them? That's not some distant question off there. It's a question we must ask here. Is there some space for them? Calvary, I've been thinking about this question for a long time now. Really, the whole time I've worked here, I've struggled to understand why I'm so attracted to you all as a community. What's our deal? What is this about? And I think it's coming together more and more. This summer helped a whole lot with the Origins Story series. And then it really helped me this week as I was sworn in to be a U.S. citizen, and I was thinking about why I love this place and all of the people here. And as I sat in that ceremony and listened to the judge, the federal judge who swore us in, and the speakers who were speaking, I was proud to live in D.C. and the type of language they used about welcoming and belonging in D.C. And they also made me think about some questions. They reminded me that I belong now, but I was left feeling, did I not belong moments before? Did I not belong in the 28 years prior to becoming a citizen? Did I not belong here when I was on TPS or my family was in deportation proceedings? Did I not belong before? And it hit me then that belonging, that these questions of belonging that I have and that you have and that we have actually must start in the church, perhaps before they go anywhere else. See, I think where I landed is that as a church, we can be a place that models what belonging could look like, even if the state doesn't catch up with us yet. I think I think I figured it out that if we model belonging, if we practice belonging, if we push people towards belonging, then we might be able to stretch the moral imagination of this country and this world, and maybe our laws might be able to reflect what we are modeling. Maybe our theology might become an embodiment of what we're modeling. Maybe our churches and our communities might be a model of what we envision and what we seek to practice. I know it seems like a long ways away, but what if every little act of belonging, every change in worship, every appreciation of a different cultural perspective, every indigenous cultural influence on our theology, every single instance that helps make people feel more belonging, what if that is the blueprint for the nation? What if that will liberate millions of people? What if the way that we are modeled to belong in a plural society, what if the work of remaking this nation and redistributing resources and reconstructing our theology, what if that is what we're modeling as a church? And what if we took seriously what it meant for people to belong, like really belong, like really have a space? So they would know that they have a place here too. What if in the way we order our church life, we're helping, singing, saying, like Langston Hughes said in 1936, I too am America. Undocumented, I too am America. Black, I too am America. Queer, I too am America. Womanist, I too am America. Immigrant, I too am America. Exiled, I still too am America. Disillusioned by the system, I too am America. Indigenous person unwilling to claim this place because of the violence, I too am America. All mixed up with multiple identities, I too am America. Any person who pushes this nation to be better, to have more space for more people and be a plural society is to America. Maybe. Perhaps on this day we might be able to sing that the church in America is a place where all the colors, like all the colors, y'all got it,